Hello, and welcome to Viewpoints, a weekly program of information on the ever-changing world of accessibility. Now here are the hosts of this program, Nancy Goodman-Torpy and Peter Torpy.
Hello, I'm Nancy.
And I'm Pete.
This week, and every week, we'll start the show with a tip of the week. Our theme this week is driving for non-drivers. Yes, you heard that correctly. We'll be talking about useful things a blind passenger can do, several organizations that have been developing cars that can be driven without a sighted driver, and GPSs that operate with both speech input and speech output. This week's tip is give up your driver's license if you can no longer see well enough to drive safely. Now, this is a lot easier said than done. I remember when my grandmother was in her mid to late 80s and her knees were shot and her reflexes were slow and her vision wasn't so great, and my mother, who was then my age now, was on her mother's case. You know, give up your driver's license, get yourself rides, take a taxi, take the bus. It'll be safer and cheaper and everything else. And my grandmother wouldn't listen. Well, guess what? Now my mother is in her mid to late 80s, I'm in my 50s, and we're having exactly the same conversation. And I hate to say it, but it's good bet in 30 years I'll be having the same conversation with my daughter, and I hope I have the sense to give up my driver's license when I can no longer drive safely.
So and, why?
Well, yeah, because you'll be the passenger. But it's a big deal, and we understand about driving being a convenience and being a sense of one's independence and a source of independence, and so do the people at the New York State Department of Motor Vehicles. In fact, they say exactly that on their website explicitly. However, they also want people to be safe on the highways, and they've got standards that you need to meet in order to drive legally. First of all, your vision needs to be correctable to at least 20/40 or better in at least one eye. So if you only have vision in one eye, it's still legal to drive. But if you're new at only having vision in one eye, I think you should get used to it for a while before you do go out on the roads. And you can't have tunnel vision, so you need your vision to be at least 20/70 throughout a horizontal visual field of at least 140 degrees. And it turns out that the state actually will issue restricted driver's license. So my driver's license says corrective lenses required, because without my glasses, I can't see as well as I would need to. With my glasses, I see fine, 20/20. So there's no big deal having a restriction on your license. Many people already have one. Well, maybe it's time for two or three. And some of the most common restrictions are requiring corrective lenses, permitting driving only between sunrise and sunset, so you can't drive at night. A lot of people are having trouble with night vision, but they're still driving. That's not too safe. Restricting the geographical area in which a person's permitted to drive, or prohibiting freeway driving, requiring special mechanical devices, or requiring some extra supports in order to ensure a safe and correct driving position. So if you need to give up your driver's license and start getting yourself rides or taxis or buses or whatever, one thing you don't need to give up in the process is your government-issued ID card. And you can get yourself a non-driver's ID, and that's what Pete's got.
I have one. It permits me not to drive, but it works as great identification for cashing checks or, as Nancy said, when other people need photo identification or a driver's license.
Now, the requirements for getting a non-driver's ID are at least as stringent as for getting a driver's ID. I mean, you don't have to pass the road test or the vision test, but the quality of your identification that you present to at least New York State is at least as stringent. In fact, when I went to renew my driver's license, I could do it by mail. What happened with you?
I think they made me show up in person. They needed another picture and some more information. They're pretty tough about people not driving, apparently.
Yeah, my picture's from 20 years ago, but by gum, you needed a new one. Turning now to our low-tech item, we'll be talking about useful things a blind passenger can do. Just because you can't see well enough to drive doesn't mean you can't perform other useful functions in the car.
Darn, you're going to make me work.
That's right. In fact, the first thing is Pete keeps his own copy of the car key.
All the time.
People think that's pretty strange. Why would you want a copy of the car key?
Well, we've run into several situations where we'll both be driving along and Nancy will get out of the car and maybe I'll say, I'll wait in the car until you come back. And she'll leave me with the keys so I can listen to my local NPR radio station, another driveway moment. And then I'll decide, well, I don't want to really be here after all. And I'll get out of the car and then all of a sudden the car is locked and the keys are inside. But if I keep an extra set of keys, that's not a problem. And there are other times, of course, when you might lock yourself out of the car. I mean, that happens to lots of people. So having that backup makes us feel a lot better.
In addition, we use his key for valet parking. Mine has the fancy fob with all the electronics built into it, but he just keeps the valet key, and then that doesn't give the valet access to the trunk, so that's a little nice.
Right.
So while we're in the car, we keep Pete busy there, too. What's your major function?
Well, Nancy likes me to try and keep her awake. The problem is, I've got to keep myself awake. So we'll often start with a cup of coffee.
And if we don't start with a cup of coffee, we start with a nap. And then he's better about keeping me awake.
That's true.
Another important function.
Feeding the driver.
This is my favorite.
That's true. Our driver gets hungry at times.
That's right.
I can pull snacks from the back seat and feed her little pretzels. It's like being at the zoo. I can even feed myself and sneak a few snacks here and there.
That's true. We put Pete in charge of music, the radio, recorded podcasts. You know, you can bore your sighted friends with our program if you download the podcast and play it over the car radio. That's a benefit. In fact, we've listened to our own recordings.
That's true. She also makes me pay for gas because sometimes it's easier to get at my credit card when her purse may be stashed in the back seat or in the trunk. So that can be another useful thing.
You know, nobody minds giving you rides. Offering to pay for their gas is something that they would actually appreciate. So this works both ways. Not only is it easier for him to get to our joint credit card, but it's nice to pay for someone else's gas, too. And the other thing is, sometimes he acts as my navigator. We'll get him a set of directions in some accessible format, and then he can sit there in the front seat and read them to me. That was before we got our GPS unit.
Yeah, I got unemployed when we got the GPS unit.
He bought me the GPS because he wasn't such a good navigator, and he couldn't read all the street signs for me.
You are listening to Viewpoint, 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 Viewpoint.
This week's focus topic is various ways of driving a car without a sighted driver. There's a scary thought. We'll be talking three little sections here, one about the NFB Blind Driving Challenge, one about the DARPA Urban Challenge, and about the Google car. So you're in for some excitement. But every few years, we hear about a blind person driving a car, or there's a scene in a movie, or you meet someone new, and, oh, did you hear about? Yeah. I'm sure you've heard those stories, too. Have you ever driven a car?
Well, no, I have never driven a car, and I've never even wanted to drive a car. It seems like such a hassle and such a scary thing to be passing other cars coming at you at 60 or 70 miles an hour. And
each.
It's just too much of a hassle. But anyway, I did have a friend of mine who we were on our way to a work picnic one day, and Fred turned to me and he said, "Hey, Pete, you ever drive a car?" And I said, "No, Fred." And he looked at me a couple of seconds later and said, "Well, you ever want to drive a car?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, how about if we pull off the road here? You can try, you know, you can drive my car. I don't mind." I said, "No, Fred." And he was very insistent. He said, "Well, we'll pass in this empty field. Come on, we'll just, you know, there'll be no problem. There won't be any issues at all." And I finally kept saying, no. And we got to the party safely.
Who was driving when you got there?
Fred. No, I wasn't interested.
Well, the people at the National Federation of the Blind don't think it's completely ridiculous to have a blind person driving a car. In fact, they've been working on their blind driver challenge for several years now. This groundbreaking initiative of the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute challenges universities, technology developers, and others to build interface technologies that will empower blind people to drive a car independently. The challenge is not to develop an autonomous car that would drive a blind person around, and we'll be talking about some other efforts to do that. The challenge that the National Federation of the Blind has issued is to develop a non-visual interface for a car that can convey real-time information about driving conditions to a blind driver so that they can use their own capacity to think and react in interpreting these data and maneuver the car safely. And what we're going to do is we're going to play a clip from the National Federation of the Blind website. You can get the whole thing if you want by yourself going to www.nfb.org and looking for their Blind Driver Challenge. And these are some of the developers of the car talking to people from the NFB. It's really fascinating what they've done.
We're talking with folks at Virginia Tech about the Blind Driver Challenge. When we opened the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute in 2004, one of the things we began talking with folks about is a vehicle that a blind person can drive, a vehicle that a blind person can get in and make driving decisions. The important component here is not a blind person getting into a car that drives them around, but a blind person getting into a vehicle and having an interface that allows them to make real driving decisions. I'm here with Dr. Dennis Hong, Associate Professor at Virginia Tech University. Dr. Hong, thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having us. This is excellent.
And Dr. Hong, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the genesis of the Blind Driver Challenge and what's going on.
The Blind Driver Challenge is a new exciting project that we're doing. This is an undergraduate design and research project. So we're trying to come up with a semi-autonomous vehicle that can be operated by the visually impaired. So as you can see in the back, this is our first version of the Blind Driver Challenge vehicle. Basically, it's a dune buggy, but it's a quite sophisticated hardware and software. It has a laser rangefinder, very sophisticated software to figure out interpreting the sensory data, and some really interesting novel user interfaces to give the non-visual cues to the driver.
I'm here with Wes Majerus, a member of the Access Technology team in the Jernigan Institute, and Wes was actually the first one to drive the blind driver vehicle here at Virginia Tech. Wes, what was the experience like?
It was a very liberating experience. I had driven a car previous to this in my dad's cornfield back in Nebraska, but this was liberating to know that I was getting audio feedback and other feedback that I could independently make the decisions of when to turn, when I should slow down, or accelerate, and it was a very new experience, feeling the acceleration, knowing how the pedals would react to my inputs, and the same case for the steering wheel.
Wes, you have anything to add?
It's been a historic day. It's kind of a neat feeling to know that I was the first person to drive the vehicle.
As you can see, through imagination, commitment, and partnership, we can truly build a future full of opportunities when we use the imagination of bright, young engineers combined with the experience and vision of the National Federation of the Blind Jernigan Institute. The Blind Driver Challenge project here at Virginia Tech is just the beginning of our takeoff into a whole new world of opportunities and technologies.
Now, how cool is that? So that was recorded actually about a year or two ago. They've been making a lot of progress. Every year they demo something new. As you heard, they were talking about the test vehicle being a dune buggy. It looks more or less like a steel cage on wheels. Well, this year they did the Blind Driver Challenge again at the Daytona Speedway, which is pretty cool, in front of a crowd of thousands and thousands of people right before a major race. And this year, the vehicle is actually an SUV, and they've got some interview bits and pieces with the driver of that vehicle. And so I think you'd like to hear some of that as well.
For most people, driving a car at the famed Daytona International Speedway would be the ride of their life. But this is something you need to see to believe, and that's just it.
Okay, I'll take it.
The driver behind the wheel of this car is an amateur, and he's blind.
We continue to take on greater risk and responsibility, and we couldn't think of anything that was riskier and involved more responsibility than driving.
The National Federation of the Blind has partnered with Virginia Tech and Torque Technologies to develop innovative non-visual interfaces for cars. The interfaces transmit information about the driving environment and communicate that to the blind driver through a pair of vibrating gloves and the seat, allowing him to independently operate the vehicle. To prove that the ability of the driver was essential to operating the car, the course was made even more challenging. Mark Riccobono didn't just navigate the turns of the racetrack. He was given other obstacles, including a slalom and drop boxes to further test his skills. The NFB Blind Drivers Challenge has created what others deemed impossible, a blind man driving, speeding past society's expectations of the blind.
Most of the people I talked to didn't believe we could do it. Now, although many of us are amazed, we believe.
So, Pete, if Fred were to offer you an opportunity to drive a car like that, what do you think?
You know, they talked about the control and responsibility of driving a car, and frankly, that sounds like a lot of overhead to me. And to be fair, part of the reason they're doing this blind driver challenge is not so much to develop a car that a blind person could drive given the proper feedbacks and stuff, but they're interested in a lot of spin-off technologies and interface technologies and ways of getting information to a blind person in different ways. Some of the things we'll talk about next in terms of the DARPA challenge that's been going on and the Google cars are cars that drive themselves a little bit more independently with a little less control of the driver, and that way the driver can be a little bit more relaxed, even though they may not be in total control of the car.
Well, and some of the other things that this NFB Blind Driver Challenge is all about is breaking down stereotypes and preconceptions. So, you know, one of the things everybody assumes is that a blind person can't drive a car. Well, if you've got visual impairments, I'm sure you've run into situations where people just assume that you're incapable of doing, you name it, something else. How do you tie your shoes? How do you brush your teeth? And by demonstrating that a blind person can do one of the most unthinkable things that everybody thinks a blind person couldn't possibly do, I think they're helping to break down a lot of doors and show people that blind people are really capable of doing a lot more than a lot of not-so-creative minds think they are.
And that's definitely a laudable goal. I mean, I think that is really the true purpose of this. You know, again, having a car where most people would like to be more relaxed in their cars, even if they can see. You know, they'd like to be toying with their MP3 players and things. But this is a great initiative, and there'll be some great technologies coming out of this.
So the next attempt to develop autonomous vehicles is the DARPA Urban Challenge. This is an update of their previous DARPA Grand Challenge. You can go to the DARPA website, or again, just Google the thing, and that's at www.darpa.mil/grand challenge, all one word.
And this is interesting because it started out as a military project to make autonomous driving machines in times of conflict. But it has a lot of other offshoots. What they've been doing the past few years, they've been challenging people to make cars and driverless vehicles that would drive through different types of obstacle courses, through different roads. And actually, the past year was the first time, or the past 2 years, I guess 2 years ago, was the first time that they actually had a bunch of cars enter the thing, and there was traffic involved and road signs and things like that. So it got more sophisticated.
It was 3 years ago. It was November 3rd, 2007.
Oh, was it that long?
Time really flies.
I guess.
You know, but it seems like, wow, they couldn't have done that 3 years ago, but I guess they did. They had all of these autonomous vehicles, so no drivers involved and nobody with a joystick working them as a remote control. These vehicles were controlling themselves. They were merging, passing, parking, negotiating intersections. They had teams from around the world that, of course, competed through a whole series of qualifying steps and then advancing to the actual vehicle testing on site. Of the 89 teams that initially applied, 35 were invited to the national qualification event, which took 8 days of testing every car. And that was co-located with the final event that took place in Victorville, California. DARPA transformed the roads of the former Air Force base in Victorville into a testing ground for these autonomous vehicles. They had over 4 miles of barriers and multiple test courses. They had 6 vehicles that actually completed the entire course in an average of about 4 hours each.
Sometimes when you make these things a competition, some scientists and engineers can really get fired up and accomplish some amazing things. And they really came a long way in just a few years with these competitions. But anyway, talking about being competitive, I mean, these days Google has been driving around their own autonomous car, and you've probably heard some news items about this.
Yeah, I have a little piece of a New York Times article. This is really the most recent culmination of autonomous driving.
Yeah.
So this is an article from the New York Times from October of 2010. And I quote, "Anyone driving the twists of Highway 1 between San Francisco and Los Angeles recently may have glimpsed a Toyota Prius with a curious funnel-like cylinder on the roof. Harder to notice was that the person at the wheel was not actually driving. The car is a project of Google, which has been working in secret but in plain view on vehicles that can drive themselves using artificial intelligence software that can sense anything near the car and mimic the decisions made by a human driver. With someone behind the wheel to take control if something goes awry, and a technician in the passenger seat to monitor the navigation system, 7 test cars have driven 1,000 miles without human intervention, and more than 140,000 miles with only occasional human control. One even drove itself down Lombard Street in San Francisco, one of the steepest and curviest streets in the nation. The only accident, engineers said, was when one Google car was rear-ended while stopped at a traffic light."
So it's been going on right beneath our noses without us knowing. They actually had some other close calls that they spoke about. So there were a couple of instances where someone stepped off a sidewalk into the path of the car, and the safety driver had, of course, hit the brake because he couldn't be 100% sure of what the car was going to do. And when they looked at what went on in the car later on, when they got the car back to the lab, they actually saw that the car had actually started to react even before the safety driver started to hit the brake. So the car had actually done a good job even in these particular situations. You know, another interesting thing about these cars is, you know, people have trouble seeing in different kinds of conditions, be it dusk or if it's foggy. Well, the cars can be outfitted with particular sensing devices, either radar or infrared, to be able to see through fog or see through different lighting conditions and stuff like that. So they can actually sense things a lot better than ordinary drivers can.
And then independent of what the conditions are, they've got sensors looking in every direction at once. Now, we all, you know, have experiences where you're looking in one direction, you see what's there, but maybe something's coming up behind you in some other direction and you can't see that, but the car can see everything at once. So it's actually better able to assess what's going on.
Right. Executives of the major car manufacturers, GM, Chrysler, they keep talking about that by 2020, this kind of technology can actually be integrated in almost all cars and can be virtually driverless. And to give you a hint of how far we are along that path, I mean, you can actually buy a car these days that will parallel park itself. Many of the cars these days have lane sensors that keep you in your lane.
So they don't need to wait for the rumble strips.
Right. They also have sensors that will sense how far the car in front is. So if you have your cruise control on and you're getting too close to the car in front, it will automatically slow you down and not wait for you to slow down. Right now, you're seeing these special high-tech items in the higher-priced cars, and they might be more expensive options. But these things, as they become more ubiquitous, they will certainly get less expensive and in more of the cars.
Now for this week's high-tech item, GPSs with speech input and output. Some of these are specifically made for and marketed to the visually impaired, but there are many other generally available commercial units that have both speech input and speech output. It seems the manufacturers have figured out that it's safer if the driver doesn't look at the GPS while they're driving, and that means essentially that everybody should be using the GPS unit blind, as it were. You know, I've got a GPS and it talks to me, but if I want to ask it a question or if I want to find out what's available at the next exit, we need to find a gas station or a restaurant or whatever, I can't do that while I'm driving without doing something unsafe. Our current GPS, Pete, can't do it either because it doesn't have speech input, but we're trying to get one that does.
We were looking at the Garmin series. There are several models in the 2300 series that, in addition to speaking to you, also have speech recognition. So you have to look for that particular feature.
And not just Garmin, but Magellan Navigation and TomTom also have speech-activated GPS units.
Right. And you might pay a little bit more for these, but in our case, I think it's worth it. As Nancy mentioned earlier, I originally bought the GPS unit for her birthday many years ago because I figured it was better having the GPS navigate than me. And it's certainly come in useful. And now that we've been using it for a while and have become more comfortable, we decided that maybe it'd be good if I could use it a little bit more while she's driving to look for some of these other rest stops and food opportunities and things. And of course, there are actually, as Nancy mentioned, specific GPS units for the blind. These tend to be a lot pricier. The commercial ones, for just everyday folks, may cost anywhere from $150 to $300, depending on the features. But some of these ones for the blind, you may wind up spending $1,000. But they'll be very easily usable by the blind. So it's a matter of making trade-offs.
And a lot of these are intended, the ones for the blind at least, are intended for people who are walking. There are different varieties of GPS. Some of them are intended for walkers, some intended just for drivers. If you want to go off-road, we have friends who take their GPS units hiking. Well, the set of maps that we have in our GPS are not going to be very useful if you're 5 miles from the nearest road, because we only have street maps.
I remember going into a Garmin store in San Francisco, and I was just amazed to see the number of different units. First of all, it was amazing to see an entire store devoted to GPS units, but they had an incredible diversity of, you know, GPS units for hikers, for people who fly planes, for people who want to go underwater, big, small, large displays, just anything you wanted.
If you're looking for a nice overview article about GPS for visually impaired people, go to Wikipedia, and that's en.wikipedia.org, and you just type GPS for the visually impaired into the search field, and it'll take you to this great article they have on the subject, where they say, among other things, there have been many attempts at integrating global positioning system into a navigation assistance system for the blind. GPS was introduced in the late 1980s, and since then there have been several research projects. Satellite navigation complements existing aids like white canes and guide dogs, but does not replace them. And there's a nice history of the development of the GPS for the visually impaired. And there are reviews of 6 brands that are specifically designed for the visually impaired. And that is the Lodestone, Wayfinder Access, Trekker, Trekker Breeze, Braille Note, and Mobile Geo. And in addition, they review another system that wasn't designed for blind people but is very accessible, and that's the CAPSIS Captain. And I'm going to spell that K-A-P-S-Y-S space K-A-P-T-E-N. So there's lots of options out there. You know, if you're in a major city, especially, having a handheld GPS that's useful for walkers could be really helpful, I can imagine. Maybe it'll help you find the next subway stop, or if you're looking for a restaurant, it can take you to a restaurant, you know, especially if you're in a strange area. That's it for this week's show. Next week on Viewpoints, we'll be talking about another mode of computer access. These are free screen readers, such as System Access to Go and NVDA, local sources of training, book groups at the public library, and using optical character recognition to help you out. If you have any questions regarding something you've heard about on the show, or you'd like to share an idea for a future show, send an email to reachout@wxxi.org or call us at 585-258-0333, and we'll try to address your question in an upcoming program.
You've been listening to Viewpoints, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. This program was hosted by Nancy Goodman Torpey and Peter Torpey. We hope you'll join us again next week for more information and updates on products for accessible living. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show by going to our website at wxxi.org/reachout and clicking on the podcast's link. Thanks for listening to Viewpoints, and have a nice day.